Well, as you've heard, in light of Friday's terror massacre in Paris, Governor Rick Snyder has suspended efforts to allow Syrian refugees to enter Michigan. In a statement released yesterday, the governor said, "Michigan is a welcoming state and we're proud of our rich history of immigration, but our first priority is protecting the safety of our residents. It's been established that a Syrian passport was found at the scene of one of the Paris attacks, and it matches a refugee who traveled through Greece recently, and that has raised concerns that jihadis are among the refugees. According to the Detroit Free Press, various members of Southeast Michigan's Arab American community say they understand the governor's caution, but that the move goes too far. Some say that vetting by U.S. Homeland Security is sufficient and that the United States needs to be a safe haven for people trying to escape the war and ISIS in Syria. The governor's move is generating both support and opposition. It's current state here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan's presidential primary election is less than 4 months away. Of course, no one yet knows how many candidates from this historically large field will still be standing when voters go to the polls. The turnout on March 8th could be quite large, which could lead to long lines and fewer parking spaces. The Lansing City Clerk's Office is proposing a plan to reduce the long waits by redistributing voters into other precincts. The city will present the plan at the first in a series of public hearings tonight in Lansing. Joining me to talk about the proposal is City Clerk for the City of Lansing, Chris Swope. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
What's the problem? Why are you proposing Lansing redraw its voting boundaries?
Well, we have 43 precincts in the city of Lansing, and we reduced that from 62 in 2007. So it was quite a reduction. And in a couple of specific areas, we've ended up with too many voters who just vote at the same place. We have some high turnout areas, and it just makes sense to split some of those up. So I'm proposing adding two precincts back. So we'll go from 43 to 45 precincts. And I think that'll help alleviate two specific areas. And as I was creating the additional precincts, you know, I was able to look at, okay, what neighboring precincts could use a little bit of a relief. So it will really benefit a lot of people. And by and large, this plan puts more people voting closer to their home.
It's, people get in habits, as we all know. Mm-hmm. I know exactly where to go to vote, and it's like autopilot, you know, year after year after year. Do you anticipate a big challenge redirecting voters, some number of voters, to a new place?
I think there will be, and we always find that when we change locations, which, you know, unfortunately we have to do from time to time, or we do because of requests to make those changes. So it definitely is an issue that we think about, which is why I want to get it into effect for the March election, because we actually have four elections next year. And really the November presidential is kind of the big game in elections that we're targeting everything toward what's going to happen November of 2016.
Under your plan, how many Lansing voters would go to a different precinct to vote?
About 8,000 out of the 80,000 registered voters, so a pretty big chunk. And again, by and large, a lot of them would end up a little bit closer. You know, we're also trying to deal with some other issues in terms of polling places. Right now, mostly kids who live in Trapper's Cove apartments and all those college town apartments, they have to drive a couple of miles and into a neighborhood that they're not familiar with, and they're a very transient population, so we're trying to get them closer to where they live. We think we'll lose a lot less along the way to the polling place, and we're trying to put them close to the bus route because we know a lot of them may not actually have cars.
How many affected voters are there, though,
in that area?
That would be affected by your proposal?
Around 8,000, okay. I think.
And how many registered voters are there in the city as a whole?
80,000.
So this would affect one out of every 10, but mm-hmm. it's designed to alleviate longer lines,
right, right.
Get people closer to where they're designed to vote. I mean, it's a number of pretty sensible moves in your view.
But you're right. It is a change, and you know, people will have to remember a new location, and we'll have people show up at the wrong place, I'm sure, but we will remind them and tell them a couple of times to go to the right place.
We're talking about a proposal to redraw the voting districts of the city of Lansing. If approved, it's hoped the plan would be in effect in time for Michigan's presidential primary on March 8th. Our guest is Chris Swope, the Lansing city clerk. Talk to us about the authority that the city has, that you have, to redraw voting districts here. What is the process exactly?
Well, it's a two-stage process, actually. The Election Commission is responsible for the precinct boundaries. So that's made up of myself, the city attorney, and the city assessor. And we have that authority. And when we make those changes, though, we do not change who represents anyone. So we're not changing who anybody would vote for. So all of these changes that I'm proposing are staying within existing county commission districts, existing state representative districts, existing ward boundaries for the city of Lansing. So no representation is changing, just where people may vote what precinct they live in.
Their city council member is still going to be whoever it is.
And then the second part of it is the city council is responsible for adopting the polling locations. So setting the specific polling places for the two new precincts has to be done by city council, as well as there are a couple that I'm proposing just changing the location of a current precinct without actually redrawing that precinct.
Have you proposed anything like this before?
Well, again, in 2007, we did a drastic reduction of the number of precincts, and that was in large part a money-saving effort. As well as, when you have 62 precincts in so many locations, you tend to have a lot more equipment to fail. And it was just a management issue on election day. And the reduction made sense at the time. I've proposed some changes in the past several years of polling locations, and city council has adopted those. We've moved several locations in the past 3 or 4 years. But this is the largest scale change I've made in several years.
Now, tonight you're starting a series of public hearings on the proposal. The first is at St. Casimir Catholic Church in the Morris Park neighborhood. I understand the locations of the hearings is pretty strategic.
Right. We are holding a meeting targeted to each of the geographic areas where we're proposing making a change. So, the St. Casimir location, we're actually proposing to be a polling place. And part of the Morris Park neighborhood would vote there, as well as some people just the other side of Martin Luther King. Right now, a lot of those voters vote at Luton School, and we have two precincts at Luton School, and one of them gets a huge turnout. It's got the country club neighborhood, which the voters turn out really well there. So we're trying to just alleviate some of that line. So it will benefit both the people who are staying behind at Luton, as well as the people who are moving to the new precinct.
You've been active in voter education and encouraging people to cast their vote. Last May, your office organized a mock election with a few not-so-serious issues on the ballot. It was a chance to get off your chest how you felt about your favorite ice cream flavor and your favorite local mascot, et cetera. But there was a larger purpose that you had in mind here.
Right.
Revisit that with us, and I'm wondering if March 8th will be the first opportunity to see if that effort had any impact.
Well, I hope it did, and it may be impossible to tell. There's so much that goes into turnout, but looking back at what we did in May, and we have done it a couple times since, we did it at some of the community centers in Lansing with kids. We had a great success with people coming out and voting on their mascot. Sparty, by the way, was the big winner, which may not be a surprise to you. But really, it's a twofold thing. It's to get our young people interested and understanding in how voting works, and it's to alleviate the fears of some of their parents. We have some voters who may feel embarrassed that they don't know how to vote. They don't know what to do when they get to the polling place. And if we can just take away some of that mystery, we're hoping that folks will feel more comfortable. We're hoping that their kids will say, hey, I voted, and they're talking about election day at school. Are you going to vote, Mom? So, you know, it's a little bit of peer pressure and hopefully making folks more comfortable.
Let's switch gears a little bit. The Michigan Senate has passed a measure that would eliminate straight ticket voting. Mm-hmm. And this is a Republican-led bill sponsored by Senator Marty Nolenberg of Troy. The GOP says not allowing straight ticket voting would essentially force voters to do more research on the candidates and really give more thought to the process of that goes into casting the vote. You and many of your other fellow Democrats oppose this. Mm-hmm. What makes Senator Nolenberg's proposal a poor idea?
Well, for one thing, it's been passed by the legislature before, and the voters have overturned it. So clearly the voters of Michigan want to continue to have this option. You know, our parties are aligned philosophically. Now, there may be exceptions, but people know that they are identifying with one party or the other. And it really is just a matter of, you know, time, how long it takes to mark the ballot. We elect a lot of positions in Michigan. If you think about, we elect three university boards. We elect the State Board of Education, county commissioners. There's, depending on what county you're in, between five and seven countywide positions. So, I mean, really, it's just like you can mark one thing that takes care of 20 things down the ballot, or you can mark everything. And clearly the voters
like that option.
Like the option, yeah. And they use it. And so taking it away, you know, I my fear is that in places like Detroit, it's just going to cause a slowdown in the voting process. Mm. They already have problems in Detroit with, you know, processing voters through. And even in Lansing, you know, I think it will slow us down.
You mentioned four elections, four voting sessions in calendar 2016.
That's right.
What are you anticipating?
It's going to be a bumper crop of the year.
I guess so. What are you anticipating for March 8th?
You know, we don't really have a track record is the frightening thing. We've had Republican primaries, but for the past 20 years, the Democrats have not used the results of the primary in Michigan, other than 4 years ago when Barack Obama was unopposed on the ballot. So we have a strongly contested Democratic primary among you know, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, and that could lead to a huge turnout that we haven't seen in a March election before. Mm-hmm. So I'm anticipating that we're going to have a lot of voters. You know, we're a heavily Democratic city. So when we have a Republican-only primary and the Democrats are a beauty contest or uncontested,
right.
You know, it doesn't really tell us what's going to happen. So this is going to be a unique, a different experience for us, and we're just going to have to prepare for it. And as you know, March, this is Michigan, so it's probably going to be snow on the ground. There are a lot of things that can happen in a March election that are not easy to deal with.
More March madness,
yes.
I guess. Chris Swope is the clerk for the city of Lansing. We've been talking about several election issues, among them a proposal to add two voting precincts in Lansing, which is an effort to reduce wait times and parking issues. Chris, thank you for being here. Good luck with the primary.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, this Wednesday, the MSU Opera Theater opens its season with an adaptation of the classic British novel, A Room with a View, by E.M. Forster. Current State's Jamie Paisley sat in on a couple of rehearsals and spoke with some of the creative minds and voices behind this new production. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Mark. Yeah, it's a very new production. In fact, one of the main reasons I had to sit in on a few of those rehearsals, including the first cast and orchestra rehearsal, was to get some of the music recorded for this segment that we'll hear. It's only the third ever production of A Room with a View by composer Ronald Nelson and librettist Buck Ross. And so one of the biggest challenges is to let the audience know exactly what to expect when it comes to the music. The director of this upcoming MSU Opera Theater production kind of cites a few auditory references.
It's definitely 20th century, but that shouldn't scare people because I think of it as being very Italianate, very post-Puccini. It's interesting. The composer is actually here in town now, and he says he's greatly influenced by Britain. I hear that in some of the interludes, but I hear much more romantic, Puccini, Italian, big climaxes, soaring melodies. And I think it's absolutely gorgeous. I think the free thinkers, the Emersons, in the opera definitely have, interestingly enough, some of the most lyrical lines. I did my graduate degree in the year 2000-2001 because I went back to school having been singing for quite a few years because I wasn't quite famous enough to get a university job without a master's degree. And I went to the University of Houston where I met both Robert Nelson and Buck Ross, the librettist. Many Michigan people would know Buck back from the 80s and 90s. He used to come up and direct for the Opera Company of Mid-Michigan, which now doesn't exist anymore. And so this was a piece that he and Bob had written in the early 90s. I did some scenes from it at an Opera America conference and just really fell in love with the music and the fact that there's lots of parts, very little chorus, which for a university is helpful because it's fewer schedules to coordinate. And I think it's a great story, and it's important that we be doing works from the last 20 years.
Now, when adapting a novel like A Room with a View, you're inevitably dealing with turn-of-the-century morals when it comes to a female protagonist, Lucy in this case, and her role in society. Again, MSU Opera Theater's Room with a View director, Melanie Helton.
They follow the novel very, very closely. And, you know, Forster was writing about sort of the crumbling of the Victorian / Edwardian era into the modern era. And so you get Lucy, the heroine, who is not your typical ingenue. She is not particularly cheerful. She's not particularly rosy-cheeked. She has a tendency to want everything to be nice. And here come these two free thinkers into her world, Mr. Emerson and his son George. And they really rock her world. But what's interesting is that she expresses herself by playing the piano, and she doesn't just play Mozart. I mean, he actually quotes a little Mozart, a little Schumann, but we always say that Lucy plays Scriabin and Liszt and Ravel, but you know, that kind of fiery thing, so that there's that spirit inside her which has been clamped down by her sort of indulgent mother, but also her cousin who acts as her chaperone, who is very prim and proper, although we find out later that her cousin Charlotte at one point had an opportunity to be in love, to have a more free life, and she turned it down. So she actually says to Lucy, I wasn't brave enough, I wasn't strong enough, you make the right decision.
Since this is a university production, director Melanie Helton has also used the rehearsal process of the upcoming A Room with a View opera as a learning tool regarding something rather vital to stagecraft, which isn't learning the music.
Martha Ruskaj is literally the lady who wrote the book on theatrical wigs, and we had met years and years ago in Santa Fe, and we were fortunate enough to get some grant money. The Worthington Family Foundation has been extraordinarily supportive of MSU Opera Theater, and we can't be more grateful to them, so we could afford to bring her out. And in fact, she's backstage right now giving classes, because in this show we have a lot of different age ranges. So she's working with the guys who are supposed to be young men, then she's working with the guys who are supposed to be older, about contouring, about how do you sort of make the face look older. In fact, I happened to see a Facebook post of hers today saying, will all of my friends of a certain age send me resting pictures of their faces? She didn't ask me. I'm thankful for that.
In the MSU Opera Theater's upcoming staging of A Room with a View, senior Kate DeYoung will be portraying the role of Mrs. Honeychurch, the mother of protagonist Lucy Honeychurch. And is there that big moment which Kate DeYoung finds particularly difficult while portraying Mrs. Honeychurch?
It's when she's confronting Lucy and she's saying, so now you want to move away from your home altogether, like now you want to leave. And it's very emotional because as a mother, you worry about your children. And she goes off on this big tangent about like the worst possible thing that could happen to her when she moves to the city. She just extrapolates from like 0 to 100 in like 2.2 seconds. And it's a great thing to see as a, like for a mother kind of character to watch her transform in those 2 seconds to get that very worrying, very tense, like wants the best for her daughter. And then she kind of comes back towards the end and is real. I think she kind of realizes that she needs to leave, but it's hard. It's a hard little lick of music and hard little emotional part.
Now, a parent dealing with empty nest syndrome should sound familiar to any parent of a college-age child, right?
Sometimes, yes. Oh, sorry, Mom. I mean, as in any relationship with your mother, my mom is very worried about me, and sometimes, you know, it's the worst possible thing, but, you know, she always comes back. She's very much, I actually draw a lot of Mrs. Honeychurch from her. My mom is like one of my role models in life. She's so loving and so caring and does 101% for me. And it's amazing to kind of almost kind of turn to her for a character reference. It's kind of making me really happy.
For this upcoming MSU Opera Theater production of A Room with a View, they turn to guest conductor Marcello Cormio to whip the musical content into shape. And since this is the third ever production of the opera, how does Cormio approach material as new as this is without a slew of past opera recordings like we have nowadays for Puccini or Mozart?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's exciting exactly for that reason, because it's something you don't have to, you know, be too much in the way of a tradition that has been so, you know, powerful before. But at the same time, what you try is trace all the references there are behind this course, which are very strong and powerful. The composer himself admitted that he's inspired by Stravinsky and Britten. I see a big neo-romantic vein in the score. There's many moments that remind me of Puccini, not necessarily in the harmonic language, but in the way the writing and the music and the orchestration all come together to respond to a basic need, which is portray feelings and emotions through the music. And also, I'm so lucky to be in a situation where the composer is present. And this is how it worked historically, much more than the way it is today, because, you know, Mozart wrote his operas in having in mind the interpreters, the singers, the people who are going to actually make it into actual music.
As with the original novel by E.M. Forster, action takes place in two locales, Italy and England. And for MSU Opera's guest conductor Marcello Cormio, the music by composer Ronald Nelson certainly signals that geographical identity as well.
There are very specific moments. Act 2 of Scene 1 is set in the Basilica di Santa Croce in Florence. And so if you ever been to Florence, you're struck right away by this feeling of being transported in an age that is, you know, Middle Age Renaissance. And there's a specific quality to it, which at times is dark, is archaic. And the beginning of the second scene in Act 1, which depicts being in this basilica, I think is absolutely, the composer absolutely nailed the atmosphere. There's a bassoon solo, there's this modal chords, there's this feeling of being transported in a different age. And then there are moments that are full of warmth and, again, this so immediate sense for a romantic melody, which you would expect from, you know, from something that is somewhat connected to Italy and the Italian, you know, operatic tradition.
Now, lastly, I remember when I saw the 1985 Merchant Ivory version of A Room with a View, I confess being semi-taken aback by that infamous bathing scene, which is done, well, al fresco, shall we say. So I simply had to ask director Melanie Helton, does that make it onto the MSU opera stage as well?
Yes, we do have a little bit of skinny dipping. I'm not going to tell you whether or not they're actually going to be nude. We do have sensibilities to be aware of, and they are students. But I think that they will certainly appear quite nude. It's quite fun.
The MSU Opera Theater's production of A Room with a View by Ronald Nelson and Buck Ross opens this Wednesday night at the Fairchild Theater on the MSU campus and continues with evening performances Friday and Saturday with a closing matinee on Sunday. Tickets and more information can be found online at music.msu.edu.
Thank you very much. Going right on, Scene 2.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Pace.
And coming up on Current State, globally, solar makes up only a minuscule portion of energy production, but that's not dampening enthusiasm for solar on a local level, including in Lansing and East Lansing. It's led to speculation that solar energy may be moving beyond growing pains. We'll hear the thoughts of two locals who are active in alternative energy. Plus, we're kicking off a new series this week on geography awareness. Don't worry, no state capital quizzes coming up. That and more after the break on Current State. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us. 3 weeks ago, officials gathered at the site of a retired landfill in East Lansing to announce a makeover. The Bertram Park Landfill, near Bertram Drive and Park Lake Road, soon will become home to 1,000 solar panels. For $400, Lansing Board of Water and Light customers who want access to solar-generated electricity can lease a panel for 25 years. A site in South Lansing will be home to a similar setup. According to some sources, these kinds of projects are becoming more common in Michigan and across the country. Our next two guests have been involved locally in alternative energy for years. John Kinch is the executive director of Michigan Energy Options with offices here in East Lansing and in Marquette. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
And John Sarver is an East Lansing resident. He's the executive director of the Great Lakes Renewable Energy Association. John, good to see you.
Yeah, thanks.
Community solar has become almost a phrase in and of itself. What does it mean exactly, John Kinch?
Yeah, I define it as allowing participants, residents, and businesses alike to enjoy the benefits of solar power without having to locate the installations on their own property.
So that does not include rooftop solar people, John Sarver?
Typically not, because with community solar, you typically have a larger installation, and so a lot of the community solar projects are ground mount in fields. But I mean, you could have one on a roof, but typically you have constraints. So typically you have a ground mount installation for community solar.
So in East Lansing, you have a local utility, you have the Lansing Board of Water and Light, joining with the municipality, the city of East Lansing, to offer solar electricity to residents. Do I have that? That's basically how it works.
Right, except it's available to all Board of Water and Light electric customers, mm-hmm. whether they live in East Lansing or they live in Lansing or Holt or Delta Township. So it's broader than just the East Lansing residents and businesses that qualify for this project.
Tell us more about how it'll work, John.
Well, there's a sponsor, in this case, the Lansing Board of Water and Light, who's working with John and Patriot Solar, who are actually going to be the developers. And then they basically provide shares. So an individual homeowner, or businesses too, or institutions can buy shares. And then they get some financial benefit. In this case, it'll be a bill credit over the life of the lease, 25 years, I believe.
But LBWL customers in Lansing can also end up getting electricity from the East Lansing solar array?
Yeah, absolutely. What we're trying to do with our program is have folks lease a panel or panels. They're welcome to lease more than one that fits their budget. And the idea is that we want to kind of fill up the one project in East Lansing first and then move on to the Lansing project second. But in truth, it's kind of a virtual solar production for folks. In other words, they're going to be getting a credit on their bill, but isn't like they're going to own a panel in one particular park at all, nothing like that. They're merely going to be leasing the rights to the power. And so we're hoping people come early and lease a number of panels, but we think between the two projects with 2,000 panels total available that we ought to be able to have enough supply for the demand out there.
And when we talk about a community solar project like these, an established utility is always involved?
Well, not always, but typically, because there's a lot of advantages having a utility sponsor. There are six utilities in Michigan now doing community solar projects, and they all provide a utility bill credit. There's a third party doing a project over near Holland, so it's possible to have a project without utility involvement, but utility involvement, for a whole bunch of reasons, is key. And because we're talking about community solar, A number of the utilities are municipal utilities doing this around the state, because it's important that people identify with the project. People like to go out and actually see the project that they're buying a share in.
And these community level projects are taking off in Michigan? Have we seen a dramatic increase in these, or what?
We are seeing an increase. I'm not sure I'd characterize it as dramatic, but I think across the nation we're seeing a lot of folks getting interested in community solar. I read a study recently that said that in 2015, the number of projects are increasing fivefold, and that between 2015 and 2020, we can expect going from 66 megawatts in 2015 to something like 500 megawatts in 2020.
John Kinch is the executive director of Michigan Energy Options, with offices in East Lansing and Marquette. John Sarver is executive director of the Great Lakes Renewable Energy Association. We're talking about community solar power projects and other related alternative energy issues here. John Sarver, the East Lansing project took off after a community survey showed support for just such an idea. Does it typically require a significant level of support from residents for something like this to take off?
We have seen all over the state where utilities are developing projects, there's significant community interest. More than the utilities even expect. But it's not just residents, too, because for this project, the city of East Lansing has committed to 10 shares. So it can be businesses and institutions in addition to homeowners who kind of get a share of the project.
1,000 panels in East Lansing, 1,000 panels in Lansing? Do I have those numbers
That's
right?
That's what we're getting gunning for, yes, sir.
Andy Blaskovitz, who used to report for the Lansing City Pulse, he's now with the Midwest Energy News, wrote last week that recently the increase in community-based solar systems might be considered the end of solar's growing pains. John Kinch, are you inclined to agree with that?
Well, again, I think John and I were just talking about this. We're really kind of all of the above in terms of the solar industry. In other words, we want to see community solar projects, rooftop solar projects, utility scale projects, something called wholesale distributed generation. So I think the idea that the industry is maturing is correct. And I think that community solar just captures the attention and imagination of people, I think, in ways that ideally allows us to have conversations and educate folks about the benefits of solar on the roof as a utility and in a community solar park.
How willing are utilities to get involved in solar initiatives, John Sarver?
Well, they're getting much more interested because during the past 5 years, costs for solar have gone down by 50%. And so it wasn't that long ago where you'd have very long paybacks. And now the economics are getting very favorable, both for homeowners who have a good site and certainly for utilities. One of the advantages for utilities is that it produces power during the summer at peak times when air conditioning loads are high. And that's when, of course, solar electric systems produce their most power at the same time that air conditioning loads are high. So utilities, because costs are going down for the equipment, kind of see the real advantage with getting involved in a significant way with their own installations and helping their customers also.
And both of you get energy from rooftop systems. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. So that's part of it. You know, we in Michigan Energy Options, or Urban Options as we used to be known for years, was the only place in town where you could go take a look at solar power. We have 3 kilowatts of solar power at our office. We're very proud of that. This is going to be 100 times that with our community solar project in East Lansing, 300 kilowatts. And we're happy to be usurped and have something bigger and more interesting to going on than our own solar panels at our office.
What is the connection between an individual homeowner installing his or her own rooftop system and the utility? Can you help me understand that? I mean, do utilities need to be involved in every individual rooftop project?
Well, unless you really cut the wires to the utility, you're involved even if you own your own system. Typically, a homeowner, let's assume they have a good site. And one reason we're looking at community solar as a good option is only about 25% of the actual homes have good sites, a southern orientation, no shading.
That's many fewer than people would probably assume. I was surprised that the number of sites were not appropriate. That's 75 to 80% or so
of homes,
not, you know, are not appropriate.
There's more commercial sites have a higher percentage of suitable sites, 65%. But homeowners, it's kind of surprising. But again, you need a, like my house has a small 1.3 kilowatt system. My front of my house is facing south. I have minimal shading on the south of my roof. So I have like an ideal location, but there's a lot of homes that don't have that sort of situation.
John Sarver, solar installation businesses are among your association's members. Tell us about these businesses. How many people right now are making a living, say, installing solar panels in Michigan?
That's a good question. You know, it's a really growing quickly. There's about 120 companies in Michigan that are involved in the solar industry in one way or the other. The latest numbers I've seen indicate that we have about 2,100 actual people working in the solar industry, and probably about a third of them are installers. So we're talking probably about 700 installers. And we have a significant number of manufacturers in Michigan, a couple panel manufacturers and five manufacturers that do the racking to put the panels on.
Can I chime in here? That
please.
Our project has, as our solar developer and installer, Patriot Solar, based out of Albion, Michigan. And at this point, we're also sourcing, ideally, we're going to be able to source the panels to be a Michigan product as well. And then the other partners in this project include Rich Vanderveen, which folks might recognize Rich Vanderveen's name. He did the Gratiot Wind Farm on 127 north of Lansing.
Can't miss it, going up north.
As well as he's done other solar projects such as in Eaton Rapids. And then we have David Gard as well. And so this is a real serious Michigan effort to make this project happen.
Do oil and natural gas companies actively resist alternative energy initiatives?
Well, that's a good question. I wouldn't paint a broad brush against the whole industry, but it's true that, you know, when you have these established industries, utility, fossil fuel industries, you know, they have a vested interest in maintaining their share of the market.
Michigan is approaching our energy policy right now pretty comprehensively. Energy choice, deregulation is at the heart of the discussion. Any thoughts on that, John Kinch?
Well, I think we're all kind of waiting to see what happens next. I can say from the standpoint that our nonprofit has worked with utilities across the state, including the Lansing Board of Water and Light, on the energy optimization or energy efficiency side of that. And you know, these utilities have made amazing sort of energy savings through that statute. So let's see what happens next.
We have to leave it there. We want to thank both of our guests, John Kinch, Executive Director of Michigan Energy Options with offices in East Lansing and Marquette. John Sarver is Executive Director of the Great Lakes Renewable Energy Association. Stay in touch. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, MSU football is back inside the top 10 in the national polls after Saturday's win over Maryland. Now the stage is set for a very important game this Saturday against Ohio State in Columbus. WKAR's Al Martin, host of Current Sports on radio and on WKAR-TV, joins me now. Hi, Al.
Mark, how are you doing, my man?
Great time of year for a football fan.
To say the least, right?
We return to the top 10 in the national polls. We're at number 9. What are the national championship implications right now?
Oh, this is huge because you look at an Ohio State team that currently sits at 10-0, and looking at how their season has gone so far, first off, they are the defending national champs. Mm-hmm. They have not lost. There's not a week that's gone by where they haven't been in the top four in the AP coaches or now the college football rankings, in which the 12-member committee will meet from here on out throughout the rest of the year. Ohio State has always been one of those four teams. So I think that especially, you know, Michigan State jumping up from, 14 to 9 in this latest poll, if they do knock off Ohio State in Columbus, I do think that they will be. It will be very hard not to put Michigan State in that playoff, seeing as though they've only had one loss this entire season. period.
I guess a couple of our immediate concerns here heading to Columbus, the MSU defense, particularly the secondary, it seems, returned to form over the weekend. But Connor Cook's shoulder has MSU fans concerned. How do you factor those into the Ohio State matchup?
You just nailed it right on the head, Mark. I mean, the secondary for Michigan State was really the shining light and the biggest component to why Michigan State was able to pull that game out over Maryland this past weekend. I was really impressed with guys like Darian Hicks and Monte Nicholson. How about, you know, three interceptions for that Michigan State secondary, one from Riley Bulla in which he took 44 yards to the house. But on the flip side, it was such an interesting press conference, though, after that game, Mark, because, of course, the talk of the town was Connor Cook. What was the update on his shoulder? Why was he not starting the second half? And there were two conflicting opinions, though, because, and I was talking to a few reporters about this afterwards, when Connor Cook took the podium after that game, Mark, of course, Connor was asked, why didn't he start that second half? Connor looks at us all and says, you know what? I felt as though I could go. I wanted to go. But Mark D'Antonio felt as though we wanted to go a different route. He wanted me to rest that shoulder. He felt as though I wasn't getting a lot of velocity on that throw. So, what, 5-10 minutes after that, Mark D'Antonio walks in for his press conference, and D'Antonio sits there and says, well, you know what? I talked with Connor, and it was a mutual decision for us to not to put him in. He felt like he couldn't go, so that's why we held him out. So there was a bit of conflicting opinions, and we saw, of course, if you watched the broadcast on ESPN, Connor Cook actually slammed his helmet down in frustration. The cameras caught him doing that on the sidelines to start that second half. So, but as far as what this injury does for Michigan State now, we'll just have to wait and see. We know when the press conference happens tomorrow morning, Mark. Mark D'Antonio does not like talking about injuries. So right. I really doubt that he will say anything alluding to giving us insight on where that Connor Cook injury is. But if he's not 100%, there is reason to be worried.
I guess that's a day-by-day thing until Saturday, so it's I won't put you on the spot and ask you how you feel about Michigan State's chances, because I think too much hinges on that. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about Gerald Holmes, though, our running back. Assess his performance for us on Saturday, and what part will he need to play on Saturday?
He is the number one back, clearly, for this Michigan State football team. And as far as the rushing attack goes, throughout that game, Mark, there were 10 Michigan State jerseys who touched that football and ran the ball on the ground. 10 jerseys. Now, granted, I mean, 141 yards total. A big chunk of that came from, as you just said, Gerald Holmes, who was fantastic. He had 18 carries for what, 87 yards. He was absolutely unbelievable. And he runs with power. He has great vision. He's got great patience. But I do think that as far as from a consistency standpoint, Michigan State's rushing attack isn't where it needs to be right now, Mark. And that's something, you know, odd to say when considering that when you look at a Mark D'Antonio team and assess the success they've had in these recent years, they have always had a solid rushing attack. Right now, I just think it's too inconsistent.
Your takeaway here, let's switch gears and talk basketball for one sec. Your takeaway from Friday night's home opener.
Oh, boy, that was fun. You know, it was a crazy weekend, Mark, because us at Current Sports, we covered the MSU men's basketball opener. We covered the MSU Maryland football game. And then yesterday we covered the women's basketball game as they played at home as well. Triple header, I don't think we've ever done that. But as far as Michigan State men's basketball goes, of course, they play Kansas tomorrow night, 10 p.m. Set your alarms if you're watching that one, right, the next morning, and you got to get up early. But they play Kansas in the Champions Classic out in Chicago. But this team, for me, the star so far for this year. Now, again, it's very premature, very early to say this, but Deontay Davis has looked like a man amongst boys right now. He's a freshman, of course, in the men's basketball, or I should say boys basketball player of the year honors when he was in high school for Muskegon. I mean, he has come in and provided so much energy. His rebounding skill is unbelievable. He can score. I mean, he brings some emotion. Fantastic. Look forward to watching Deontay the rest of the year.
WKAR's Al Martin, host of Current Sports on radio and on WKAR-TV. Thank you, Al.
Thank you, Mark.
Boy, Well, last year, National Geographic magazine created Geography Awareness Week to help young Americans better understand geospatial issues and recognize their roles as global citizens. Michigan State University plays the lead role in Geo Week in mid-Michigan with a variety of public opportunities designed to create an awareness about geography as both a discipline and as a part of everyday life. Current State will present several discussions on the many facets of geography this week. We lead off today's conversation with MSU professor Joe Darden. Dr. Darden's research interests are in the areas of urban social geography and neighborhood inequality. He's the author of 7 books. Peter Whorf's conversation with Dr. Darden kicks off Current State's Geo Week series.
Geography is the study of spatial analysis, let us say, and place matters. In any aspect of geography, we always start with the fact that place matters. Place essentially influences one's entire life from birth to death, really, because where a person lives, residentially speaking, influences where that person will go to school, where that person will essentially shop, where that person will get access to other kinds of opportunities, including jobs, and so forth. So in a sense, we in geography look at inequality between places. Meaning, for example, families that reside in places what we call concentrated poverty, these are neighborhoods where the 40% or more of the population lives in poverty. Those individuals will have a very, very difficult life chance because the school system will usually be less, essentially equal to the other schools within the metropolitan area. A child born there and remains there over time will also have a lower life expectancy, poor health, because the health aspects of that person's life will be impacted by where that person lives. And given that, you can look at inequality between those neighborhoods that are poor and those neighborhoods that are affluent, and you will find extreme inequality between those places. Also, you will find over time, there will be segregation that is created by where they live. This is not necessarily influenced by law, but influenced by where they live. And since it's geography as an issue, whenever you have boundaries drawn around those places, for example, that denies children an opportunity to go to school, based on where the higher schools are, they are restricted by the quality of education they receive. No fault of their own. In that sense, geography plays a critical role, and it should not be underestimated that that matters.
This is Current State here on WKAR. I'm Peter Whorf, and I'm speaking with MSU Professor Joe T. Darden as we follow Geography Awareness Week here at Michigan State University. Dr. Darden's interests encompass urban social geography, residential segregation, immigration, and socioeconomic neighborhood inequality. Dr. Darden's the author of numerous books, including recently Detroit, Race Riots, Racial Conflict, and Efforts to Bridge the Racial Divide. You use the term spatial mismatch in relation to geography. Can you expand on that?
If the population resides in one area where the jobs are few, that person will have an unequal unemployment opportunity compared to those people who live in places where jobs are very plentiful. It also influences one, auto insurance, for example. If you live in places of concentrated poverty, you will have a higher insurance rate, even though you may be a very, very perfect driver. Right. It doesn't matter because the insurance rates will be influenced by where you live. And the worst place you can live, believe it or not, are those places of concentrated poverty. If you can avoid those places, it's best to do so. Some people cannot avoid them, but it's best that they do. And so if you talk about trying to talk about equality, equality is not going to occur unless the population try to reside in places that already have characteristics that influences the quality of life. So neighborhoods matter, and they're unequal based on socioeconomic characteristics, race, ethnicity, immigrant status. Those neighborhoods are unequal. And if the neighborhoods are unequal, the opportunities for life chances will also be very unequal. That is what geography is all about. And we try to measure those things to see whether over time the situation's getting better. You hear much in the news about income inequality. We talk about income inequality based on places. And so where you live can be influenced in terms of income inequality, educational inequality, occupational inequality. All of those things matter. And we map those things out. So geography is more than mapping. We use the maps for analysis purposes to convey to the people how unequal places really are. That's what we do in terms of geography.
Professor Joe T. Darden, we're speaking with him as we observe Geography Awareness Week here at Michigan State University. On Current State, we'll be bringing you this week-long series. Dr. Darden specializes in urban social geography. He's the author of numerous books, including recently Detroit Race Riots, Racial Conflicts and Efforts to Bridge the Racial Divide. Professor Darden, thanks very
much. You're quite welcome.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, Graham Beal ushered the Detroit Institute of Arts through that city's bankruptcy. Now a visiting Hannah Distinguished Professor here at MSU, Beal is helping the university search for a new director of the Broad Art Museum. We'll talk with Graham Beal about what lies ahead for the university's landmark art museum. And illegal wildlife trading is the fifth most profitable illicit trade in the world, and it's not just happening in faraway places. It happens here in Michigan, too. MSU Associate Professor Meredith Gore works to find solutions. We'll talk with her about her work. All that and more tomorrow here on Current State. We hope you can join us then, and we're glad you could join us today. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.